Hi everybody, welcome to the Scuba Dive Magazine podcast. This week I'm going to be covering the death of Jared Hires, who was a very well-known and loved member of the diving community and the general manager of DiveRite, who has died this week on a dive in the Plura Cave system in Norway, which is the same cave system as the 2016 documentary Diving into the Unknown, where a team of divers risked their lives and legal repercussions to recover the remains of their friend who had also dived in that cave system. Now, I'm going to be reading through the DAN preliminary accident analysis and explaining anything that might be complicated. But first off, let's start off with Jared himself. So Jared was a US cave explorer. He was 33 years old, and he was the general manager of the equipment manufacturer DiveRite. It was a family business co-founded by his father, Lamar, in 1984. Jared grew up in the technical diving tradition of the USA's cave county of northern Florida. DiveRite had started producing the specialist kits needed by tech pioneers, but not commercially available at the time in the 80s, and evolved into a manufacturer associated with a range not only of extreme, but also recreational dive gear influenced by the requirements of cave diving. Lamar bought DiveRite outright in 1997, becoming its CEO, and his wife Leanne, its CFO, last month had seen the start of the company's 40th anniversary celebrations. At around 14 years old, Jared began his formal cave training, and at 15 became the youngest closed-circuit rebreather diver to have been certified. DiveRite had recently produced its own rebreather, the Optima. Describing diving as my escape and happy place, he went on to develop his cave diving skills through regular local experiences, but also became a scuba diving instructor at 18. He described the certification as significant for him because it was the first he had achieved independently of his father. He went on to become a TDI technical rebreather and cave and cavern instructor, and said he was always destined to work for the family business. As a boy, he helped to price tag products, and from 14 was regularly assisting in the shop and taking calls. After graduating from the University of Florida in 2013, he continued to gain all-round experience in the manufacturing, servicing, and marketing sides of the business, and became DiveRite's general manager. He had dived challenging systems, including ones in Mexico, the Giant Cave in Belize, Russia's Order, the Molnar Janos in Hungary, and locations in Norway, Israel, and the Bahamas. So he's very well experienced in cave diving and rebreathers. Jared had dived Plura, which is the deepest cave in Northern Europe, 2 years previously, and was back at the location as part of a team of nine experienced cave divers of different nationalities. On the afternoon of the 3rd of April, he and two other divers had entered the system as more of a bit of a check dive to test their equipment to reach the wedding chamber feature. So the DAN preliminary accident analysis goes like this. So as part of their injury and fatality monitoring activities, Divers Alert Network is in the process of collecting all necessary information to understand the events leading up to and potentially causing the accident that happened in the Plura Cave system, Rana, Norway, on April the 3rd, 2024. The basis of this preliminary analysis, which was done on the April the 9th, 2024, includes an interview of one of the diver's dive partners who witnessed the event, conversations with the diver's father after the event, and the downloads of the CCR, the closed circuit rebreather controllers, of all three divers on the dive. So the Plura Cave system. The Plura Cave system is the deepest cave in Northern Europe and the most popular cave diving destination in Scandinavia. In the parts of the system that are suitable for diving, accessible through the Plura River, the limestone and marble formations form some narrow and edgy, but also big passageways and rooms with visibility described as far as your light can shine. The water temperature in the cave ranges from 36 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's 2 degrees Celsius in winter, to 44 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's 4 to 7 degrees Celsius in the summertime. It's cold. It is proper cold in this system, with the entrance lying under ice in the winter months. The dive itself, a team of three experienced rebreather divers plan to execute a checkup dive in preparation for a deeper dive the following day to confirm that all of their gear was in full working order after travel. All three divers used adequate equipment that they were familiar with and wore adequate thermal protection for the dive. It was their first dive in the in Pleura on this trip. However, Diver 1 and Diver 3, Diver 3 is Jared, by the way, had dived the system in previous years. Diver 1, who is the dive leader and the witness, took the lead, followed by Diver 2 and Diver 3, who was Jared, at the back. The first half of the dive was uneventful, with a maximum depth of 34 metres, that's 110 feet. All three divers surfaced after 30 minutes in the airfield wedding chamber. The dive was planned as a circuit, but the wedding chamber did mark the approximate half-time point of the dive. The team briefly discussed and confirmed that all equipment was in working order and everyone was feeling well, and then they descended again after 2 minutes at the surface in the same formation with Diver 1 at the lead and Diver 3 at the back. The CCR controllers logged this as a separate dive. Consulting the logs provided by the team, the descent for this second dive was also uneventful for all three divers until minute 16, when Diver 3's log shows a sudden descent from 25 metres to 29 metres, that's 82 feet down to 95 feet, in less than 20 seconds. At this point, Diver 1 had turned around to assist Diver 2, who was deploying a backup light after their primary light had failed. Whilst reconfiguring their formation to put Diver 2 in the lead, Diver 1 witnessed Diver 3's light moving erratically and recalls hearing Diver 3 screaming, potentially trying to articulate a problem. Because with rebreathers, you have the loop that instead of a normal second stage, you can, the kind of like the reverberations, you can kind of talk and you can kind of hear what people are saying a lot better than a second stage. It's not perfect, but it's not unusual for rebreather divers, especially because it's much quieter, to be able to audibly communicate basic things and communicate like fundamentals. When Diver 1 reached Diver 3, he was already in full tonic-clonic convulsions. His loop was not in his mouth, so his mouthpiece was out, but was found to have been closed. So with rebreathers, if you're breathing from the mouthpiece and you just take it out of your mouth without doing anything, the loop is going to flood with water because it's not pressurized. So what you have to do, you need to close it, is usually by flicking a switch or turning something. So that means that Jared had consciously known that it was going to be coming out of his mouth. So he had closed the loop, ready to switch to bailout, but was unable to get his bailout regulator into his mouth by the time before the onset of the seizures. After unsuccessful attempts by Diver 1 to secure Diver 3's airway, he proceeded to swim the still convulsing diver towards the exit, a distance of roughly 250 metres, that's 800 plus feet, with several depth changes. When Diver 3 had stopped seizing after approximately 3 minutes, Diver 1 tried to insert a regulator into his mouth again, but was unable to unclench Diver 3's jaw, so he proceeded to swim out of the cave. He signaled Diver 2 to swim ahead as fast as possible to alert the surface and call for assistance, which Diver 2 did. A diver at the surface was able to meet them close to the exit and assist in bringing Diver 3 to the surface. Diver 1 and Diver 3 surfaced after 31 minutes, which was 17 minutes after the onset of convulsions. CPR was initiated immediately, and oxygen and AEDs were ready within minutes after surfacing and used before and in conjunction with local EMS response via ambulance and helicopter. Unfortunately, all resuscitation efforts by the team at the surface and EMS over the course of almost 2 hours remained unsuccessful. After communication with the deceased diver's family, it had come to light that he had an unprovoked seizure for the first time the previous year, and that there is a family history of very rare, and to this date, medically unexplained seizures, in these cases connected with overexertion, stress, and dehydration. The diver told his dive partners that morning that he had slept well, he was not jet-lagged, and was feeling rested that day. It should be mentioned, though, that the week before the trip to Norway, the diver had displayed symptoms of a viral infection with flu-like symptoms and gastrointestinal involvement, which may have added to potentially existing electrolyte imbalance and dehydration from intercontinental air travel. All of that traveling, after being sick, your body is still recovering, even though you kind of feel well in yourself to do things. Your body is still recovering from what happened the previous week, and then you have air travel, which is just tough anyway. Granted, you're sitting down for most of it, but it is actually a lot of hard work for you, both mentally and physically, and these things could have added up. Dan includes a word about oxygen toxicity and why they think this was most likely not an instance of oxygen toxicity. When reading about seizures in diving, a logical first conclusion people jump to is a central nervous system oxygen toxicity, which presents in symptoms just as the ones described. Plenty of literature is available on the topic, and training courses as early as open water, or at the very least enriched air nitrox courses, cover this topic. Rebreather divers are very, very aware of the three H's, the hyperoxia, hypoxia, and hypercapnia, which each can lead to disabling injury and death and drowning whilst diving. The review of the logs of this dive does not support the theory of an oxygen-induced seizure. At no point before the event did oxygen levels or cell readings spike significantly. The PPO2 very briefly, they put in brackets less than 1 minute, exceeded the high set point to 1.3. The rebreather was set to 1.2. If you're unsure about rebreathers, you depending on the design, you either have one cylinder of like nitrox, or you have two cylinders, one of diluent, which is like air, and another one with pure oxygen. And as you continually breathe the loop, which is normally just about a lungful of air, as you exhale, it gets recycled. It gets cleaned through a scrubber to get all of the carbon dioxide and whatnot out. And then the gas gets analyzed by oxygen cells. They determine whether there's too much oxygen or not enough oxygen. Again, depending on the design of the rebreather, it either automatically adds a bit of pure oxygen, or it will alert you to do it manually, and it just recirculates it, and it just continues basically. And what this is saying is that it was set to 1.2, which is pretty reasonable, and it only briefly went up to 1.3, and they say that changes in the PPO2 are only seen after the event and are easily explained by the solenoid still firing and the efforts of Diver 1 to vent and inflate equipment to exit the cave. So the only anomaly occurs after the event, and it's very easily explained. It's unlikely that this is a cause of the event. The narrative suggests that Diver 3 seems to have felt the onset of a seizure, which makes an underlying medical condition more likely than an oxygen-induced seizure. These seizures rarely present with an aura or a warning sign, so they just kind of happen, which better matches what they see in the dive computer. A medical event is also more consistent with the duration and quality of the witnessed seizure, which would best be described as a grand mal rather than oxygen toxicity. Unprovoked seizures can develop suddenly and at any age. The risk of reoccurrence of a seizure after an individual has experienced a single unprovoked seizure has been published in a comprehensive literature review in 2023, and it states that the likelihood of seizure recurrence is between 25% and 41% in the first 6 months to 2 years. So to summarize, after careful review and consultation with experts in diving accident analysis, we conclude that this tragic accident was caused by a medical event and predisposition of the diver, and that neither equipment failure or error in human-machine interaction is responsible for the outcome. The diver was likely not aware of the implications that a first-time unprovoked seizure could have. The dive team did everything humanly possible in this challenging environment to rescue the diver. In summary, Dan feels that it is important to educate the diving community about medical and physiological issues that, whilst easily manageable at the surface, can prove fatal when experienced underwater, especially in extreme environments. Okay, so moving on from that, I'm just going to do some Ask Mark questions, answering your questions over the previous week. The first one comes from Aidan Finucane, who says, I recently saw a light from deep blue that has multiple colours. Can you please explain why I would use colours like green, blue, or red versus the standard whites? The red one's easy. The red is because a lot of underwater life can't see red wavelengths because it's not much use to them. The red wavelength of light, as we all know, disappears quite early on because the water absorbs it. So what you can use that for is it's usually for photos. So because your camera, especially anything with a an autofocus, it needs something. It needs enough light to be able to like pick out details to autofocus and like construct the shot. However, if you shine a white light in a fish's eye, it's just going to leave. Whereas with red, they don't really see it. We can, the camera can. So that allows you to sort of compose your photo a bit easier. And then when you go to actually take your photo, you use the strobe flash or something, which is white light. Green and blue, you don't see too much. You see some in the like ultraviolet end of the spectrum, but they're usually sold as like UV lights. It's not strictly UV because that can be quite dangerous. It's a very specific wavelength. I forget the exact number. But what that can do is it can like activate bioluminescence. You have to have like special filters and things to be able to actually see it properly. But that's pretty cool. Green? I don't know of green. The most that I can think of, it's for like communication. I was talking with someone from Custom Divers. They've just developed a new like light. It's more of a strobe. You fit it to some 2-inch webbing and you can set it to strobe, and it either has like a very quick strobe, a slow strobe, or a continuous light, and three different colors. And that's just a simple way of passive communication between yourselves and your buddies. So before the dive, you say, okay, green light, for example, and it's only strobing like slowly, everything's fine. And then you push a button on it and it changes to a quick strobe. You can say, okay, green quick strobe is I've lost you, but everything's fine. I'm just looking for you. And red, there's something wrong with me. Red fast flash, there's something really wrong with me. White, whatever, you can come up with whatever that means. But yeah, I don't think I've seen any green specific lights. Yeah, the only green that I've seen before in a dive torch is for a laser. You get some torches nowadays that have built-in laser pointers, so you don't have to get too close to whatever you're trying to point to. We get red ones, we get green ones. Green ones like penetrate the water a bit further, so they're a little bit better. But yeah, I've never seen a green light emitting torch. I don't really know what the main benefit for that would be. Someone might know in the comments, but I don't think I've ever seen one, and I can't think of why you'd need one other than communicating, basically. NC Buckslayer 8244 says, I just purchased a new tank and I had a question about installing the valve. I've watched videos on installing the valve with a small amount of O2 safe grease on the first couple of threads. Is this correct and is it absolutely necessary? Yeah, as far as I'm aware, that's how I was taught to do it. That's how I've read to do it. If I'm installing a new valve, I typically have a look at the instruction manual first. They don't typically come with valves, but a quick Google search will bring up a installation guide. And yeah, you put O2 grease on the first two threads, very very small amount. It is just to coat the threads. It's not really there for the O-ring. You don't want too much grease because then it can build up as it goes as you screw it into the actual neck of the cylinder. It can it'll squeeze all the excess out, and then that interrupts the O-ring. And too much lubrication on that O-ring really leads to extrusions, because the O-ring's a bit slippery. As soon as you pressurize the cylinder, the O-ring kind of slips out. It's a bit more of a pop, more of a loud noise coming out of it. But and it's just to help prevent galvanic action, because you've got two metals touching one another for years on end. They confuse together. So just a very light film of grease is useful. And it's usually an O2 safe grease just to cover all bases, really. If you do get some enriched air nitrox in there, it just protects it and it's not going to react. Basically. NI Bload 72 says, hi there. First, I'm very new to scuba diving and definitely got the bug. Good. Do you have a very detailed video of a complete scuba build, from building a backplate and wing to building your octo? I've heard some terminology that is new, like swivel pin, for example. Thanks again. I imagine over the years I've done how to build a backplate and how to build a regulator. I'm sure I have. It's a lot easier than you think. I remember when I first saw all the scuba equipment and all that kind of things, and all the fittings, and you're like, oh, struth, especially with back plates, it seems quite daunting. But when you actually get it in front of you, it's really simple. Back plates especially, it's just 2-inch webbing. You just thread it through the back plate. And it's pretty tough. If you make a mistake, you just go back a little bit. Regulators are a bit more fragile, but again, they're still pretty tough. As long as you don't over-torque things or cross threads, then yeah, they're really easy to assemble and manipulate. But I'm sure I've done a video. If I haven't, I will. Traveling Chaz 239 says, I was wondering, I'm 6'3", Kostruth, and I have a backplate, but it seems to be pretty short. I have a hard time reaching for my manifold. I've looked for a tall version of a backplate, but not having much luck, so I'm hoping you can point me in the right direction in possibly finding one. I know Techline definitely does a range of tall and short backplates. X-Deep they do a regular and a short version. I think it's 175 centimeters, which is about 5'10", 5'11". So you'd come under the regular, but they're a very different backplate compared to a traditional one. I think Halcyon does quite a few shapes and sizes for backplates, and there's lots of smaller custom divers. I imagine they do something. It kind of depends where you are. There'll probably be someone out there. I mean, people used to make their own. So find someone who's good enough working with 3 mil sheets of steel. Give them a pattern, and I'm sure they'll be able to cut it out for you. But yeah, as far as the bigger names, my mind immediately goes to Techline, Halcyon. And then I'd be just talking with like custom divers or Kent Tooling, because they tend to make things more custom, as the name would suggest. Joel Suresh 2106 says, what do you think about the Scuba Pro Supernova? I'm currently using an atomic split fin. I'm currently looking for a fin to handle strong current. Supernova, yeah. We have the newer S-Tech fins, which are made from a stiffer material now. And I haven't used them myself. My editor, Mark Evans, he has. And I was chatting with him about them, and he said that they're like the Supernovas on steroids. So much more power. And they're a very similar design, the S-Tech. You can fit these little metal plates on them, which is quite an interesting feature, to adjust their buoyancy. So if you're diving in fresh water or salt water, you can adjust them. Or if you just want a heavier fin or a lighter fin, you can literally adjust the weight of your fins. But yeah, the material itself is a bit stiffer, so you get a bit more power. And they have that same, I forget what Scuba Pro call it, but they have the same system where you can separate the blade from the foot pocket itself. So yeah, I'd be leaning more towards the S-Tech, and I imagine they're fairly similarly priced, or at least the last time I saw it, they were quite similarly priced. They're newer, so the S-Tech might be a bit more expensive. Yeah, that's where I'd be looking for if you're in the market for that style of fin. Hydriver 100 says, are there any ways that someone with a hyperactive gag reflex can learn to scuba dive? Is an expensive full face mask the only way? It kind of depends what sets it off. If it's like salt water getting in your mouth, then yeah, full face is going to be the best way. I can never promise that salt water will never get into your mouth. But if you really want to keep water away from your nose and your mouth, that's going to be the best way. If it's like the mouthpiece physically going into your mouth, then we do have shorter mouthpieces. There's like traditional ones that go a fair way into your mouth, so you can bite down on them. But we have, ones like Apex Aqualung's Comfort Bite. They're pretty short. They don't go much past your like premolars, if that. And you don't have to bite down very hard on them to hold them in place, especially the Comfort Bite, because it's got a little bridge that like sits on your soft palate. But yeah, if that's what sets you off, yeah, it is probably full face mask is probably the best way to go. It is just one of those things you kind of have to try out to find out. But if you have a chat with your local dive center and just say, hey, I've got this really hypersensitive gag reflex, can I try out one of your regulators before I sign up for a course? I'm sure they'd be willing to oblige, because they want to help you out. Just have a chat with them, see how it goes. If you can't get on with it, that just kind of is how it is, unfortunately. Most divers that I've taught haven't had an issue with it, but I can't remember anyone sort of saying, oh, hey, I have this hyperactive gag reflex. They may have had one and never mentioned it to me. Nick Thomas 4567 says, if using a transmitter, do you still need a SPG? I do my main, not currently on my stage, a transmitter only. It's a new setup, so after a little advice, thanks Nick. They're not strictly necessary. Transmitter technology is pretty darn good nowadays, and as long as you check the battery and swap it over at a reasonable interval, and your dive computer as well, then yeah. I know plenty of divers who only dive with a transmitter. It's nice to have that analog backup, because it can't run out of battery and it can't run out of signal. It is just an analog SPG. However, yeah, as long as you look after both the computer and the transmitter, and you don't like have really long arms that you're going to run out of like signal strength, you should be perfectly fine. I can't remember the last time a transmitter's failed on me. That they are very reliable nowadays. That being said, I still dive with an analog SPG. I don't know whether that's just tradition or like failure proofing. I do like a brass and glass gauge on my left hip, just because, yeah, redundancy. basically. But that being said, I'd be perfectly happy only diving with a transmitter if that was the only option. A lot of first ages, the more basic first ages, only have a single high pressure port. So yeah, I'd be happy just slapping a transmitter in that and just running with that. And that's it for this week. I, of course, wanted to cover the Jared's story, and I didn't want to cover too much of sort of other news, because there wasn't that much of news to note, and I didn't want to get too much. But I didn't want to cover just the story. I wanted to keep a bit more of the standard sort of lineup with answering some Ask Mark questions. And I'm just going to leave it at that this week. So yeah, thank you for listening, everybody. And of course, safe diving.